Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Republicans vying to replace outgoing Ohio Senator Rob Portman gathered last night at a Baptist church in their first public gathering before the primary. They played to an audience of nearly 1,000 at Genoa Baptist Church, just north of Westerville. Josh Mandel said he had no time for, quote, squishy Republicans, end quote, that don't stand up to Democratic leaders Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer.
When Pelosi and Schumer in power, they jam it down our throats. And that's why I say, when I go to Washington, I'm not going to listen to the Republican leaders. I'm going to use two documents as my guide. The Bible in one hand and the Constitution in the other.
It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, Cleveland.com State House reporter Laura Hancock. Welcome back, Laura.
Hi.
And Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. Welcome back, Andy.
Good morning.
And Laura Bischoff, who covers politics and state government for Gannett, Ohio. Welcome back.
Good to see you in person.
Okay, so I know, back to the studio. Yay. Hey, Laura, you know, this made us all stop. Josh Mandel's reference last night, once again, to the Bible, Laura Bischoff. And I was kind of curious about that. It made us stop and double check. He is Jewish.
Yeah, he. Okay. Josh Mandel is Jewish. He grew up in Beechwood, and but he's making a play for the evangelical vote, and he hasn't been shy about that at all. And my colleague Haley B. Miller did a nice takeout on that and how the evangelical vote within the Republican primaries is pretty crucial.
Yeah, and while Josh is Jewish, he has also used the line that he wants to stick to, quote, Judeo-Christian values. So he has thrown in the Christian side of it too, so that might be also playing to this you know, the far right conservative crowd that he's trying to win over in the primary.
Right, but he's still Jewish, Laura Hancock.
Correct. However, like, his current partner is really Christian. She's written an op-ed about a miscarriage she had, and she talked a lot about, she quoted the Bible, and it was like the New Testament. So, I mean, he doesn't live in a world where it's just only Jewish people. I mean, he's, you know, mixing with evangelicals. And yeah, I mean, he's going to need to if he wants to win.
And do you think that this plays? I mean, do you think that saying that you're bringing the Bible to Washington, is that what they want to hear? Is that all they care about, Andy?
I think it's all a certain group of people care about in the state. And I think the question is how high of a percentage of the voters care about it that deeply. I know that the people who would care about it, you know, when you see social media posts and memes from conservative groups and far right groups, they say that we need more of the Bible in D.C. We need more of prayer in D.C. But how many people are really swayed to vote that way? And is that a majority of the Republican voters voting in the primary, or is it going to be a small percentage? That's the question.
Right. And then, of course, there's the general, Laura Bischoff. And last night he said that his personal feeling is that there should be no separation of church and state. Of course, that was a hit with the crowd at the Baptist church, but I'm wondering about, you know, in a general election.
You know, it's interesting that he says he's going to take the Bible and the Constitution with him to Washington, and yet to say that he doesn't think there should be a separation of church and state is absolutely contrary to the Constitution.
There, yeah.
You know, I think it's such a crowded field in the Republican primary. And there's a real competition, I think, to attract that Trump voter. You know, President Trump won Ohio by 8 points twice, and he remains very popular in the Republican primary voters crowd. So I think that Mandel is particularly provocative on social media as well. Like, he does things on Twitter, I think, to kind of stir the pot and get attention.
And look at here, we're talking about him for 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, it's
effective. Must be working. Yeah.
And you do have a state that former President Donald Trump won over with an overwhelming majority, but then you also have many candidates in the field vying for that Trump voter spot. So does that, you know, if you try to attract that, do you get all of them, or does that field of supporters sort of spread out among the many candidates that are out there? And then also you got to ask yourself, well, in the general election, a lot of people voted for Donald Trump, but back in 2016 during the primary, a lot of people voted for John Kasich. So there was, at that time at least, this this feeling among Republican voters that maybe in the general, sure, they're Republican, so they'll vote for Donald Trump. But maybe in a primary, they are looking for something maybe a little different than somebody like Trump.
Hmm. What I think is interesting is that Matt Dolan, who's a state senator from the Cleveland area, just got into the race.
Yeah.
And he seems to be playing for the non-Trump voter.
He was a standout on that score last night.
Yeah, so I think his strategy is that like all of the other candidates who are trying to attract that Trump vote will split it, and then he can maybe, you know, collect enough of a percentage to win just with the non-Trump supporters.
Hmm. Yeah. Laura?
Yeah, I just think that right now it's kind of almost like a race in the GOP primary to kind of be the most outlandish, to get the most of attention. And we'll see what happens in the general election, because if somebody really, really out there wins, then there's a better chance for whoever wins the Democratic primary to actually beat them.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Yeah, Andy?
And I think, again, this is just another statewide election that's going to be an interesting barometer of how much of a sway does Donald Trump and his particular brand of politics work in Ohio. So, you know, again, he lost the 2016 primary, but he won the general election pretty heavily in both general elections for president. But then 2 years after his first general election win in 2018, you have somebody like Mike DeWine, who ran for the primary in the governor's race against somebody like Mary Taylor. Mary Taylor ran and tried to be more of the Trump selection in that race, and she didn't win. So is it name recognition, like somebody like Mike DeWine? Is it attracting the Trump voters, or is it a little bit of both? And I think, again, this is an election where we're going to find out more of where the Republican politics lay in Ohio.
I think that, you know, Mike DeWine just had huge name ID over Mary Taylor and a financial advantage for sure. And he was somebody who was able to kind of thread that needle in that he got an endorsement from John Kasich and he got an endorsement from Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. But things, it's hard to imagine, but things have gotten even more polarized since then. The pandemic and whatnot.
Right. Only in America can you make a virus a political issue.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Matt Dolan, the only candidate to distance himself from Donald Trump last night, he said he would have certified the 2020 presidential election. And I was wondering how that crowd responded to that.
I wasn't there, but I understand it wasn't super well received.
I mean, he has a point. You don't really have a choice. It is pretty clear what Congress needs to do. And that was what he was arguing, is that like he had to put his personal beliefs aside. But that did not play probably well with the local crowd because, you know, there's still a component of the country that, you know, falsely believes that the election was, quote, stolen.
They touched on immigration, the wall, the opioid crisis, the infrastructure bill. Any thoughts about what kind of issues? Is it going to be sort of that identity politics, really, and not a lot of policy?
I certainly think in the primary that's the playbook for most of the candidates. And I would say that's probably true on both the Democrat and the Republican sides.
Let's talk about the Democratic side for a minute. The winner in May, in the May primary, will face either Democrat Representative Tim Ryan or Progressive Attorney Morgan Harper. Ryan has been racking up the fundraising dollars. How's that race shaping up at this point? Much of anything?
Well, what we are seeing right now is, again, it's very early in the race still, but we are already seeing endorsements coming out. So with Tim Ryan, he was endorsed by current U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown. And again, it's sort of early for endorsements to come out. So I feel like because that did happen so early, that was maybe Sherrod Brown trying to make a statement that this is the person he wants to run in Ohio. I don't think there's a bigger Democrat you can get to endorse you than Sherrod Brown. He's the only one who seems to have figured out the winning solution for a Democrat to win Ohio. And so with that endorsement coming out right before the campaign financial filing, I think that was a big step for Ryan. But you still have Morgan Harper out there campaigning and trying to raise money. And so I think that, you know, this race is far from over. But the endorsements the bigger endorsements that have been coming out have more sway towards Tim Ryan.
Having an opponent in the primary, Laura Bischoff, is that you know, is that better than not? I mean, it does raise the, you know, visibility of it a little bit.
Sure. You know, they say in politics that there's two ways to run, unopposed or scared. So Tim Ryan shouldn't take Morgan Harper's race for granted. But, right. he's definitely the clear favorite.
Yeah.
But I think when you do have an opponent and on the Democratic side, it might force you to run further to the left in order to win the primary. And then you have to sort of maybe try to go back to the middle during the general, and then same for the Republican side.
Yeah. Ryan, though, I mean, I guess he's a moderate Democrat in this day and age.
In 2021.
But he's got good, solid liberal credentials, right, Laura Hancock?
Right. And, I mean, he's really big into the dignity of work thing that Sherrod Brown is constantly harping on, that they need to focus on the middle class and the blue-collar worker and making sure that they get a fair cut. And so I think that will resonate. And if the Republican primary picks somebody who's super out there, Tim Ryan will definitely have an advantage if he wins on the Democratic side.
Okay. There is an election coming up in 8 days. Early voting is underway at the Board of Elections on Morse Road. The hours are 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. Local school board races have provided a lot of noise, but there's a contested House seat, the 15th Congressional District, formerly occupied by Republican Representative Steve Stivers. Trump won that district by 14 percentage points. It's up for grabs now, or safely Republican. All things being equal, it must be pretty safely Republican. But are there any buts in this? Anybody?
Well, I think there was some recent poll that showed that Mike Carey is up by 11 percentage points, maybe. Mm-hmm. The district runs from like Upper Arlington all the way down to Vinton County. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, according to Cook Partisan Voter Index, it's like a 9 percentage points favors Republicans. So, yeah, Mike Carey should be able to win that race. The fundraising is very competitive. Allison Russo, who's a Democrat state rep, she raised $550,000, mm-hmm. Compared to Carey's $548,000. So, and that was for the July to mid-October period. So it's very tight in the fundraising. It all comes down to turnout.
Turnout, right.
And, you know, we've already talked about what is Donald Trump's appeal statewide. But I think when it comes to specific districts, and specifically this district, this is very much a pro-Trump district. And the fact that it spans out to the east side, the eastern part of Ohio, into parts like Chillicothe, the fact that he endorsed Mike Carey and he won so heavily among other Republican challengers in the primary, or a special election primary, I think that shows that he's got this race. He's clearly the favorite in this race.
Yeah, Donald Trump won Ohio by 8 points, but he won that district by 14 points.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Last month, Ohio Republicans asked that an ad by Democrat Allison Russo be taken down. They objected to tying opponent Mike Carey to House Bill 6, the controversial nuclear bailout law. Did the ad get it wrong, Laura Hancock?
Well, first of all, TV stations can't take down ads. They can't be forced to take down ads. Mm-hmm. But Allison Russo's campaign was referring to some emails that came up in the investigation surrounding House Bill 6, and he was on the email train referring to, it was him and some other coal lobbyists, and because that's what he's done professionally, is he's been a coal lobbyist, and it just kind of, like, they proposed a series of amendments that they wanted to House Bill 6. And so Allison Russo's campaign ad said, he's tied to this. He came up in the investigation. Now, Mike Carey has not been charged, mm-hmm. And the company that he works for has not been charged either. Mm-hmm. But, they did get some amendments.
But there is a connection, and lesser things have been made of lesser things, or more things have been made of lesser things.
It's true, but
in the world of politics.
But if we're going to talk about people in the political arena being part of HB6, that's a really long list of names of people who wanted amendments in. It became a pretty big, comprehensive energy and utilities bill. So there wasn't a single industry in that sphere that didn't try to get their hands on it at some point.
the list of lobbyists that were involved in that bill, it was like cast of thousands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. And people said, if the Democrats don't make hay about this, then they've completely gone around the bend. So it's no surprise there. Anyone's going to, you know, anything you can.
And it's been their big...
Oh, I was just going to say, there's plenty of hay to be made.
Yes,
I mean,
exactly.
You know, this is the largest public corruption case in Ohio history. It's the biggest open public corruption case in any state house across America right now. It involves 4.5 million ratepayers, a Fortune 500 company, the former Speaker of the House. It does not, and it hits everybody's pocketbook.
The cast of thousands because it's that big.
Yeah. Exactly.
And this is the in the Democrats' playbook right now is to talk about transparency, accountability, and trying to tie these charges of corruption to Republicans and to Republican candidates. And so it's been part of what they think might work here. But what we saw in the past, for example, Larry Householder, who was already charged by U.S. prosecutors, still won his reelection campaign a couple of months later. So does it work? That's still the question.
It did force Republicans, though, to come out fighting back, which is interesting. I mean, they are taking it seriously enough. However, like when you saw the Ohio House, I mean, here the Democrats had kind of had this thing handed to them on a silver platter. There's this huge corruption scandal, and they actually lost seats in the most recent election. So I don't know if they're communicating it very well.
Well, yeah, and that's a common theme, you know, that is interesting. Some people said that they couldn't use it as effectively as they might have because Democrats voted for Larry Householder for Speaker, and that compromised them.
Right. Larry Householder would not have become, he would not have returned to Speaker had he not gotten support from House Democrats. Mm-hmm. He was voted in with 26 Democratic votes, 26 Republican votes. So, you know, they enabled Larry Householder's comeback. What I think is interesting is, and I think that's maybe the reason why in the last legislative, like when why Larry Householder was able to win and Dave Greenspan, who was a whistleblower on it, lost his seat, is that the Democrats weren't able to make enough hay out of it. They weren't able to capitalize on it. And you look back to 2006 during the BWC investment scandal known as CoinGate, there was a champion on that was Mark Dan. He beat the drum of public corruption all the way to the Attorney General's office. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats that year were able to sweep almost every statewide office except for auditor. Mary Taylor won that seat.
We're going to be right back. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. That is Laura Bischoff of Gannett, Ohio. Also with us, Laura Hancock of Cleveland.com and Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides, our weekly reporter roundtable. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A controversial bill that would have banned vaccine mandates in Ohio is off the table for now. Republican House Speaker Bob Cupp on October 15th cited a lack of consensus for that bill and others like it. And the next day, when Republican State Rep Scott Lipps tried to schedule a hearing on a different bill that would ban all childhood and adult vaccines, put the kibosh on that, too. That may not be the end of it, though. There's a move afoot to maneuver around Speaker Cupp. We're talking about that today. Laura Bischoff, she covers politics and state government for Gannett, Ohio. Also with us, Cleveland.com Statehouse reporter Laura Hancock and Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. So, Andy, the announcement by Bob Cupp is a bit of an about-face for Republicans. Mm-hmm. It surprised a lot of people. Why are they moving on from efforts to ban vaccine mandates?
What we've seen over the course of those past couple of months is many, many hours spent towards testimony and committee hearings on all sorts of bills that would either ban all vaccine mandates, ban COVID-19 vaccine mandates, ban it in the public sector, ban it in the public and the private sector, maybe just exemptions on these on some of these mandates. And so what we have seen through all of this debate is that there is no consensus among the Republican House, which has a supermajority in the Ohio House, the Republicans do. And so they just can't land on this issue.
They say there's no consensus among members of the House. I'm wondering about that. Or is it power plays in the background because because big backers of Republicans mm-hmm. have put the brakes on it? Laura Hancock?
Yeah, I mean, all the business groups oppose these bills. And that's the traditional like Republican base. And so when you have kind of these more like rogue people saying, well, we want medical
freedom. You call them rogue, but they're more, that's yeah. more the majority.
Yeah.
But it used to be a fringe group. It used
yes.
to be a very
yeah.
small minority. But because of everything that happened in 2020,
right.
we saw that group get a megaphone. And I think through this debate and with more sunshine, more spotlight on these issues, I think more people have kind of gone away from it and said, oh, wait a minute, maybe we should back off on this issue because these groups don't like it, this group doesn't like it, and maybe this isn't the right way to go.
I just wonder, really, if they put it for a vote today, you know, if they put something like that and just voted it up or down, it might pass.
Yeah. They don't want to vote on it, though.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because I think if it fails, then the anti-vaccine mandate people will be upset with them. And if it passes, then the business community and the healthcare community would be upset with them. So it's really kind of a no-win to hold a vote on it. And I do think that there's a whole bunch of factors going on here. One is Bob Kupp is a lame duck speaker, and he is probably the first guy in Ohio history to become speaker who didn't, like, fight and claw his way into that position.
Right.
Right, like
the reluctant speaker.
The reluctant speaker. Well, he filled a void after Householder was out.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's already been a serious faction in the House Republican caucus, and there has been since Cliff Rosenberger left. So it's kind of in disarray already. And then you also have a little bit of a waning of the influence that the business Republicans have over Republican politics.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that the anti-vaccine movement switched their messaging from, you know, false claims like this causes autism, which it does not,
right,
to it's a matter of medical freedom. We should have control and autonomy over our own bodies. Mm-hmm. We have these individual rights. And that is a much more appealing message to conservative lawmakers. And so they've gained strength. And then COVID comes along and it becomes like this perfect springboard for the medical freedom people to advance their agenda. So I think there's a lot of stuff kind of
yeah.
happening.
Yeah.
It was really interesting because after the health committee meeting was scheduled, Speaker Kupp sends a memo to the health chairman saying, you're not having this.
Right.
But he also has to send it to the press. And I don't think all internal communications are being sent out. You know, so to me, it shows that he might not have the power. And mm-hmm. so it's almost like he had to embarrass him a little bit to get him to comply.
Well, but did Scott Lipps not get that memo?
Well, after, yeah, because he did cancel the meeting.
Oh, yeah, he did. But
figuratively, did he get the memo that they're moving on?
Because he went ahead and scheduled the meeting anyway.
Well, they showed up, you know, the medical freedom, anti-vax people showed up at his house in Warren County and then at a condo he owns around here protesting. And it seems like shortly after that, that's when he scheduled,
yeah.
you know, and so it's like, I don't know if he's trying to keep them happy. I don't know if you can ever make them happy enough unless he like got rid of all medical interventions.
And parliamentary or, you know, the on the technical side of committee process, it was scheduled for possible amendments and a possible vote. And maybe what he was thinking was that they could just hold a vote on it, get it out of his committee where it could just sit in a room and not be moved to the House floor. And I think that could have been part of the strategy there. But that's when Kupp sent the letter out and said, no, I'm ordering you to cancel this meeting.
So this now that means that schools and businesses, they can have their own mandates. I mean, that's going to go forward. So who's ticked off about that? The anti-vax people.
Correct.
So they're still, even though they didn't want to vote on it, because one way or the other, it would, upset some interest group.
The perspective from the business community is like, we offer you a choice to work for us, and these are our terms of employment, so you can bounce if you don't like it. They're not happy, but whenever you hear the discussion in the legislature, they talk about like how a business can make a choice for you that affects you for the rest of your life, and they never bring up the fact that this is public health. They never bring up the fact that over 20,000 Ohioans have died of this illness. There's never the perspective.
And, of course, we've reached that strange intersection of deaths and births for the first time ever, right?
Yeah, Max Philby of the Columbus Dispatch has a story in today's paper about how the number of deaths last year exceeded the number of births in Ohio. It was a trend line that was going to cross over at some point, but COVID accelerated that.
Right.
And that's the first time, I think, in 112 years that they've been keeping these records.
Wow. Yeah.
I think what's interesting about this fixation on these anti-vax mandate bills at the state level is that you look at there's grassroots signals happening that tells lawmakers, like, this is a serious issue. We need to really listen to this because at the base level, there's a big upsurge in the number of people that are running for local offices.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times they're running because they're mad about vaccines, or they're mad about mask mandates, and so there's a lot kind of bubbling at the grassroots level, I think.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about, in particular, school boards and the nationalization of the issues that school boards are dealing with today later on in this, I think on Wednesday at 10.
Another thing to bring up is that the Ohio Senate and Senate leadership said that they didn't want to take on these issues either, and I think that played a big role. But, we've talked about if a bill were to hit the floor, would it get enough votes or not? And I think one of the biggest issues here is that there's really, from what we're hearing and from what we can tell, is there when they say there's no consensus, they really mean that, like, the individuals can be split on several issues. So maybe they are against COVID-19 vaccine mandates, but they're only against it in the public sector. And then there are other people who are against it in the public and private sector.
Mm-hmm.
And you really couldn't thread the needle on any of these issues. And that's why they were locked in this room for caucus for so many times.
Now, I heard that Republican Jennifer Gross, who's co-sponsored that bill, is working on an end run, the old discharge petition. How does that work, Andy?
If you get enough members to sign on to a discharge petition, you can put your bill onto the House floor and bypassing the Speaker's decisions to not put it up for a vote on the floor. And we've seen this several times. We've seen it with what the so-called heartbeat bill was in that moment of limbo for a while, too, a few years ago. And that is the mechanism they're trying to use now to get Representative Gross's bill onto the floor.
And Laura Hancock, what are you expecting as far as their success?
I don't think, honestly, in the health committee there's enough votes for it to get through. I think they can bypass the health committee and go straight to the floor. We don't know.
Okay.
But I don't, when I count what I think what people's opinions are, I don't think it would pass. So she's got, if she wants this bill to go forward. However, last time we called to find out how many people had joined, I mean, it was like 13.
Yeah.
So it's not.
Okay.
And you need 51.
Gotcha.
It's a pressure tactic, though. It also, the risk, though, is you sign that discharge petition and you tick off the speaker, and you could, depending on the speaker, get punished and have your committee assignments
ignored.
Reshuffled.
Right. Right. It's a calculated risk. All right. So there, Senate Republicans also appear to be backing away from legislation over mask mandates. Those kinds of things? Is there just a softening in general on all of these issues?
I think so. I think that because of where we are in Ohio when it comes to the spread of the coronavirus, where we are in with the mandates that have come down and the mandates that have kind of been pulled off since then too, I do think that we're getting a signal from the Senate and the House that they do want to start working on other issues.
Well, let's bring up another issue. Ohio's new license plate.
Oh, yeah, the plate. The plate rollout.
God darn it. They had one job, right? What in the world? I mean, they got the plane going the wrong way.
Well, it's an old, you know, it was one the original plane, and so to like us today, it looks like it's flipped, but that's how it was designed.
Yeah, but didn't they check with an expert? I mean, didn't they run it up the flagpole for
if we're the first in flying, we better know what the plane looks like.
Yeah.
So to explain to the listeners, the Wright B Flyer, designed by the Wright brothers and tested at Kitty Hawk, but most of the work was actually done at Huffman Prairie in Dayton. Take that, North Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, this is a never-ending, you know, debate.
But it looks, the way the brothers flew it, it looks almost like they were flying it tail first, but that was the design of it. And under state law, you have to have birthplace of aviation on the state license plate. So the new plate design, unveiled by Governor DeWine, has a little banner of birthplace of aviation being towed by the Wright Flyer, but the Flyer was backwards. And so shortly after the press conference ended, experts were like, hey, what's up with the Flyer? Why is it pushing the banner rather than towing it? And so they had to flip the Flyer.
So you could say it was the wrong Flyer?
It was instead of the right Flyer, it was the wrong Flyer. They had to flip the Flyer.
And by the way, it's wheat, shafts of wheat in the foreground of the, which corn is the number one export in Ohio. I mean,
honestly, my idea for a plate is like homage to the ag industry in Ohio. We could have corn.
It's the number one.
Right. We could have, you know, some side of corn grits and then bacon and eggs because we're a big egg layer state and a big pork producing state.
And soybeans for the off years.
And then I think one of the funniest memes I've seen since last week when this all came out was the Hell is Real billboard.
Yeah.
That was funny. Yep.
That's probably coming up next in a specialty plate bill.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. Joining us today, Laura Bischoff, covers politics and state government for Gannett, Ohio. Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow and Cleveland.com State House reporter Laura Hancock. Laura, the Ohio State Board of Education voted to rescind their anti-racist resolution that the board had passed in the wake of George Floyd's murder in 2020. So I guess the makeup of the board changed in the meantime. Mm-hmm. Okay, what's going on?
And basically, issues about race and, you know, critical race theory are becoming sort of like a buzzword on the Republican side and are going to be already proving to be going up to the midterms a big issue. And so they replaced it with a resolution just saying that there are gaps based on race, but also based on poverty and other issues. And so it was 10 voted to rescind, 7 voted keeping the original resolution, the anti-racism resolution, and then 2 people were not there to vote. And and, you know, the people who voted to rescind the anti-racism resolution were largely white, conservative, and a combination of people who are elected and appointed.
And to be clear, critical race theory is not taught in Ohio schools, all things being equal. I mean, that whole thing is a red herring.
No, and I talked to one of the leaders in the kind of side to get rid of the anti-racism resolution, and I said, I mean, does this mean you can't teach anything controversial? Like, can you teach that, like, around 20 million Native Americans died of smallpox that was introduced by Europeans? And he's like, well, if that's proven, you can teach that, but you can't teach that it affects Native Americans to this day, which is kind of a little shocking because I think, I mean, I wouldn't consider
what happens in the past does affect our circumstances today.
Right. I don't know.
Whoever we are.
Yeah. So it's
that's why we study history, right?
Correct. Yeah, and there isn't, as far as like bearing on the state, it's not like every school district has to follow this. However, if you're applying for grant money, the whole idea is like maybe you will align your own internal policies with that. So we'll see.
Yeah, there seemed to be a narrative when the board was having a hearing on the issue, the narrative from the people who wanted that resolution to be revoked is that they believe that systemic racism has been solved. And so, you know, kind of in keeping with what Laura just said, is that there are people who say, well, sure, you can teach the history, but you can't teach how history impacts the present. And that seems to be the main sticking point for the people who wanted to get rid of the anti-racism resolution.
So we can't teach that by putting in the interstate highway system and the outer belts in all the big cities and how it destroyed neighborhoods for generations. That's not allowed to be taught.
Yeah, and apparently, by extension, why we have so many strip malls.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's just called
history.
Learning about our world around us. Okay.
I think, I think another interesting thing when you look at this is we saw a lot of steps, we saw a lot of progress and momentum on the issue of racial injustice after the murder of George Floyd. Mm-hmm. And these were decisions that were made pretty quickly, and people might say reactionary to it. But we would see what I think many people would say are progressive steps towards racial justice. And the fact that we're now seeing sort of a backtracking of that a year later is concerning to a lot of people.
Well, we'll follow that. By the way, we're going to be hearing from Paulo DiMaria, the recently retired state superintendent of public instruction, who's now leading the National Organization of State Superintendents of Public Instruction. We're going to be talking with him tomorrow, I think, about a lot of this stuff and, you know, what's going on with the school board. Laura Bischoff, the Columbus Dispatch published text messages between Governor DeWine and Nan Whaley that showed they were in unison on a number of issues. And we saw them, you know, cheek to jowl kind of a thing after the mass shooting in Dayton a couple years ago. That was before the governor's race. What do we know? What did they tell us?
So my colleague, Jesse Baumert, filed a public records request with both the governor's office and then the cities of Cincinnati and the cities of Dayton to, you know, get the text messages between these three rivals, because Nan Whaley and John Cranley are running against each other for the Democratic nomination for governor, and then they each want to take on who they presume will be the Republican nominee, Mike DeWine. So it's a good idea, and it was pretty revealing. It showed that Nan Whaley and Mike DeWine, who, you know, they live in side-by-side counties and are kind of like Miami Valley people, they had a lot of praise and admiration for each other over leadership after tornado, like more than a dozen tornadoes hit Dayton after the mass shooting in August of 2019. But then once Nan Whaley announced that she was going to be running for governor, the text messaging and the love kind of dropped off.
Right. Yeah. Politics and bedfellows. By the way, I've been corrected. In January, Paulo DiMaria becomes president and CEO of the National Association of States Boards of Education, not superintendents. Apologize for that. What Nan Whaley texts with John Cranley, who...
They've long been friends, and they co-founded, I think, the Ohio Mayor's Alliance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, now they're running against each other.
John Cranley, of course, is Cincinnati, yeah.
Right, so it may have cooled a little bit. They... I think the only thing that really got much attention was there was a exchange about their opinion of Bill Seitz, who's a state representative from longtime state representative Republican from Cincinnati. That was something like Seitz sucks. Yes, yeah. He does. And I think Cranley called Bill Seitz to apologize. Whaley did not, and then Seitz called her Nasty Nan.
Okay, the nasty word rears its ugly head. You, Andy, you've been following news with the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio. Mm-hmm. A state consumer watchdog is calling for a shakeup. That would be the Consumers Council.
Yep, the Ohio,
which
the
has been kind of neutered since the Kasich administration. What are they calling for, and who cares what they think?
Well, you know, I guess consumers should, even though the Office of the Ohio Consumers Council doesn't have as much power or money as it used to. But the OCC has really been at the forefront of several of these issues that people have been fighting against First Energy on. And the issue here is that over the past few years, well, much longer than that, but especially in the past few years, the PUCO has made decisions that the OCC has found to be, you know, in the best favor for First Energy and not what would be the best for consumers. And so they've taken these issues to the Ohio Supreme Court. And what they're highlighting is that over the past 3 years, the Ohio Supreme Court has ruled against the PUCO three different times. They've ruled in three different cases that the PUCO made a decision that benefited First Energy over consumers. And so the OCC says this is a clear example of why on the PUCO there should be a consumer representative, at least one seat where the person is there to represent consumers.
Let's, for the listeners, a little bit of background. The Ohio Consumers Council is the lawyer for residential customers. So its view is to protect residential consumers. And the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio is a five-member board. They are appointed to staggered terms. This is a good-paying job. I think they all make well over $100,000 a year. And
with benefits.
And it's a balance between Democrats, Republicans, and Independents. They have enormous power and influence over, you know, giant corporations as well as consumers' pocketbooks. And there's a nominating committee that comes up with a list of names and gives it to the governor, and the governor picks, and then the Senate approves. But behind the scenes, there's a lot of maneuvering over who gets on that board.
For example, when Sam Randazzo, who was the former chair of the PUCO, was selected, we have since found out that it was Governor Mike DeWine who wanted Sam to throw his name into the list of candidates. Then the selecting committee picked Randazzo as one of their finalists. And then DeWine gets that list back and says, oh, hey, I want Sam Randazzo, even though he was the one who called him in the first place to run.
Right, right, right.
And so what we've seen here is, you know, again, we'll talk about, you know, HB6. First Energy has already admitted to bribing Sam Randazzo $4 million for favorable treatment in the PUCO as chair, something Randazzo says he's not guilty of. And so this is just a list of things where you have the Ohio Supreme Court, the Consumers Council, information that we're learning through the federal investigation that things are not working out for consumers when it comes to the decisions that have been made when it comes to First Energy.
I should also say that Sam Randazzo has not been charged with anything.
No, he has not, and which is really interesting, but there's a lot still percolating over there. Not suggesting anything by that. Just real briefly, because there's a bunch of other stuff we need to talk about, but why during the Kasich administration, did they downgrade? Do you remember the Office of Consumers Council?
Yeah, Janine Migden Ostrander was the Consumers Council, and she was very forceful in representing.
Wouldn't have been the first. I mean,
but she was very. I don't want to say strident, but she was vociferously representing the Ohio consumers, and that just didn't sit well, and they ended up cutting the OCC's budget, and I think they were going to just like eviscerate it.
Yeah,
and then she said, "No, don't do that to the agency. I'll step down."
But still, they cut the budget to nothing practically. They don't have.
They also took. I don't know if it was under the Kasich administration or prior, but they took away the call center that the OCC had to take consumers' complaints.
Yeah, I think that was during Kasich's administration.
And they said, no, PUCO already does that. Let's just have one call center.
And this is in the wake of the Ohio's utility structure moving towards deregulation. So this would have been a time where it would have been helpful to have a stronger Ohio Consumers Council happening at the same time.
And there's not always been a strong consumers council. Rob Tongren was in there,
right?
And he ended up getting charged with ethics violations and resigning.
When I was covering it, it was Bill Spratley. who was very aggressive. So, kind of like just that was their role. I mean, because as you've described, the PUCO is largely populated by people with interests in the
ties
big utilities.
To the industry.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The big utilities. I really want to talk quickly about the Ohio Redistricting Commission. In sworn statements on Friday, Governor Mike DeWine, Secretary of State Frank LaRose, and Auditor Keith Faber all acknowledged that they, quote, had no involvement, end quote, in creating Ohio's redistricting maps, which is really interesting, since they're actually sitting on the commission that voters approved, you know, a few years ago, on it made constitutional changes to ask for them to be involved. So who did draw the maps? Isn't it the commission? Who the heck?
Well, it was done largely by staffers behind the scenes, and then it got rolled out to the members of the commission, according to depositions. There was a giant paper dump into the Ohio Supreme Court on Friday, all these depositions and public records requests and like thousands and thousands of pages of documents related to the lawsuits saying that the maps were unfair.
And the whole process behind the Ohio Redistricting Commission has been in the spotlight because ever since the beginning of this commission convening in August, advocacy groups said this is not how it should happen. They wanted the maps to be drawn publicly. They wanted a more public process and a transparent process. Instead, what we saw is that these staff members in the Senate and House GOP caucuses said, hey, here's our map. And they were subjected to some questioning to say, how did you come up with this? But by and large, it was just, here's the map, here's how it's split. And there wasn't a lot of talk about how did you come to these decisions? How did you draw it the way you drew it? Or why?
And today is the 25th. And on the 31st, they have to have their congressional maps ready, and they haven't even had any meetings. The Democrats have asked for meetings, but they haven't had any. And if the commission can't pass a map, which they need both the Democrats to approve, then mm-hmm. it goes to the legislature,
which used to do it anyway,
right? Which has a GOP supermajority. So
well, the legislature had its first crack at it, and they missed the deadline. So that's why it's with the redistricting commission.
And then it goes back.
Right.
To the legislature.
It would be a 4-year map. And so we might very well, depending on what the Ohio Supreme Court rules in these cases, just for the indefinite future, just have a process where we keep having 4-year maps and 4-year maps and 4-year maps.
And the Ohio Supreme Court will decide the outcome of 3 lawsuits filed so far over the legislative maps for the Ohio House and Senate. The Ohio Republican Party wants the Justice Jennifer Bruner, Democrat, to recuse herself. Justice Pat DeWine, the governor's son, Republican, has already said he wouldn't recuse himself. Nobody can force them to recuse themselves anyways. But what about the makeup of the court? What does that tell us at this point about how they might respond to these?
They're actually, it's a majority Republican court, but it's split. And you have Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor last time did rule in favor of the Democrats. And so there's hope that she might be more of an independent voice. We'll see.
Yeah.
It's a 7-member court. There's 4 Republicans, 3 Democrats, and it's led by Maureen O'Connor, who is a Republican. So,
yeah, the last time around when the maps were challenged, the court went the way of the Republicans. But because the makeup is a little different, there's more Democrats on it. There is hope among advocacy groups that it could go the other way.
Right. And Maureen O'Connor, the Chief Justice, right, is one of the people who voted against it back then in 2011.
Yep.
So, yeah. Okay, well, we are just about out of time. I want to thank all of you for joining us. It's so nice to have you back in the studio.
It's great.
Face-to-face. Andy Chow, reporter for Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
And Laura Hancock, State House reporter for Cleveland.com. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for Gannett, Ohio. Thanks to you as well.
It's been a blast.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.